We take this opportunity to warn those governments who've entered this evil alliance of America against the Islamic State to back off.
This masked figure is the British man, Mohammed Amwazi.
From that young British boy who lived on this street to the ISIL executioner we see today.
The methods that they have used, specifically in the case of Mohammed Amwazi, have played a contributing factor to him becoming Jihadi John and ISIS's chief executioner.
But how did he get to Syria?
They don't appear to have stopped anybody going off to these places. And that then begs the question, well, why didn't they stop anybody at all? Which comes on to issues of policy and higher considerations.
In this week's In Focus, we ask what happened to Mohammed Amwazi and what does it tell us about Britain's strategy on terrorism at home and abroad?
This British man has to pay the price for your promise, Cameron, to arm the Peshmerga against the Islamic State. Ironically, he has spent a decade of his life serving under the same Royal Air Force that is responsible for delivering those arms.
He has become the face of ISIL beheadings. A face covered that had not been seen. The knife-wielding executioner who was British. But who was the British man behind the mask? Nobody knew until the 26th of February 2015.
There's some breaking news to bring you now. The Islamic State knife man, nicknamed Jihadi John, has been identified by the Washington Post. He's been named as Mohammed Amwazi from West London.
Suddenly, he had a name, and he lived in West London.
This is the street that Mohammed Amwazi lived with his family. He was born in Kuwait but moved to the UK when he was just 6 years old. He grew up here, went to school here, had friends here. But 2 years ago, aged just 24, he fled to fight in Syria. A year later, those notorious beheading videos started appearing online. So what happened to Mohammed Amwazi for him to go from that young British boy who lived on this street to the ISIL executioner we see today?
We know that Mohammed Amwazi went to this school in northwest London. Then head teacher of the Quinton Kynaston Academy says she never suspected that the reasonably hard-working pupil would become the man we know him to be today. When Mohammed Amwazi was identified, like journalists across the country and across the world, I started searching for information on him. Within hours, I was introduced to one of his close friends from high school. I've been in touch with this friend in the hope that he will speak to us on camera. He's simply too concerned to do so, but he has agreed to talk to me on the record if I hide his identity.
Mohammed was pretty much a normal kid until about year 9, when he was about 14 years old. Then he started isolating himself. He would hang around his younger brother mostly. I know his brother's in Syria now too. Sometimes they would say crazy things, but we didn't really pay any attention. I don't know where they got some of their views from. It wasn't from school. There wasn't a group of them at school or anything like that. Even the Muslim kids thought he could be a bit out there. It was definitely from outside, whatever he started being interested in.
After high school, Mohammed Amwazi went on to university, where he got a degree in computing in 2009. That summer, he travelled to Tanzania, but on arrival, he was refused entry. He was put on a flight to Amsterdam and is said to have been questioned by MI5. First on suspicion of wanting to fight for Al-Shabaab in Somalia, then in an attempt to recruit him as an agent. When Mohammed denied and declined, he was returned to the UK. The following month, he travelled again to Kuwait to stay with his father's family. This time, he was allowed in. He stayed there for 10 months, got engaged, and made only one brief trip back to the UK in the meantime. The second time he returned to the UK in July 2010, he was told he couldn't return back to Kuwait because his visa had been denied. Within the next 3 years, he had fled to Syria.
Throughout this period, it is claimed that the British intelligence services continuously approached Mohammed Mwazi. He called it harassment and went to well-known advocacy group CAGE to make formal complaints. CAGE were in communication with Mwazi for 2 years, and they spoke to the Washington Post reporter, who ultimately heavily quoted them in the article revealing Mwazi's identity. When the story was published, CAGE held a press conference that was broadcast live across British television. CAGE's research director, Asim Qureshi, said he had been misquoted. He also talked about the Mohammed Mwazi he had met.
You might be surprised to know that the Mohammed that I knew was extremely kind, extremely gentle, extremely soft-spoken, was the most humble young person that I knew. This is why when I'm asked, is the person that you see on those videos the same as the person you remember, Mohammed Mwazi? It's difficult for me to say that yes, these two people are exactly the same. Because there's one character that I remember, one person, one young, kind person that I remember, and then I see that image, and there doesn't seem to be a correlation between the two. And even, maybe I think we want to clarify that the Washington Post kind of recorded my comments incorrectly. While I think that there are some striking similarities between the young man that I remember and the person we see on the video, I can't be 100% certain. He's got a hood on. Come on, guys. The guy's got a hood on his head. It's very, very difficult.
In the one-hour press conference, Qureshi went on to detail how MI5 had hounded and continuously harassed Mwazi in the years leading up to his fleeing to Syria. He questioned the intelligence service's role in Mwazi's radicalization. But it was one unrelated comment he made which was immediately splashed across the headlines.
He was such a beautiful young man. Really, it's hard to imagine the trajectory, but it's not a trajectory that's unfamiliar for us.
His describing of Mwazi as a beautiful man was slammed in the British media, and CAGE were accused of being apologists for extremism.
Our emphasis has been very much on...
6 weeks on, I've come to a CAGE event on Britain's counter-terrorism strategy to talk to Asim Qureshi about his comments.
How do you reflect on that initial reaction to CAGE's press conference on the day Mohammed Mwazi's name was announced?
Thing is that we said everything we wanted to in the press conference. The misrepresentation was calculated. It wasn't the case that we said something that we felt was wrong. In fact, I stand by everything that I said in that press conference, in the sense that the man that I knew once upon a time was a decent person, as far as I could tell. What happened to him after that, I don't recognize that other human being, or that other person, or what he's become. So I can't change what I said. What I would say is that actually think about the media and the role that the media plays in purposely misconstruing what people say, because at no point did I ever say that what he's doing now is okay. Quite the contrary, we're completely against anybody anywhere being executed, whether it's by ISIS or whoever else.
It's a complaint that many Muslims make of the British media, that their voice is either dismissed or misrepresented. They are often unhappy about who is given a platform to represent them in the media. Kerry Boulevard of CAGE ended up walking off live on air in protest of an interview conducted by Sky News' Kay Burley.
Let me ask you straight off the bat, what level of harassment by the security services here in the United Kingdom justifies beheading?
Many viewers took to social media to vent their anger at her line of questioning, which they saw as incessantly undermining and patronising Boulevard.
How do you feel about the beheading?
I'm kind of appalled that you would ask me that question. Muslims are human beings as well.
Don't be appalled. Don't be appalled. Just answer the question if you would, please, sir.
Your question is inherently Islamophobic and racist.
Nonsense. Get over yourself. Who's responsible for these beheadings? Do you condemn his actions?
I've already said... I'm sorry, I'm not answering that question. It's a ridiculous question. I've already gone through this and dealt with it.
I've met with Kerry Bullivant to ask him what he made of his Sky News grilling.
They did their classic move and moved to massive oversimplification straight away. They jumped on Arsim's comments about a beautiful man and lost all of the nuance of what we were trying to say. The point we were making is, how did he go from what Arsim described as a beautiful man to a murderer? And how did that journey happen? And how do we cut that journey off and stop it from happening again so that we're all safer? All of that nuance was lost, and they just wanted to jump on Cage and jump on Arsim and myself on a personal level and call us apologists and jihadi apologists when it's ridiculous. We've been speaking out against these people long before the British government even knew who they were.
It's not the first time that the British media or British authorities have jumped on an individual in this manner. In fact, there would be a long list of Muslims who would make the same allegation, that personal smears are used to sideline the important points being made. Other times, blunders become more serious, and even academics in Britain have suffered. I've come to the north of England, to Edgehill University in Lancashire, to meet with Rizwan Sabir, academic, lecturer and counter-terrorism expert. He also has very personal first-hand experience of how the police and intelligence services can get it so very wrong. In 2008, Dr. Sabir was arrested and held for 7 days after downloading the Al-Qaeda training manual as part of his university research into terrorist tactics. Ultimately, he received £20,000 compensation and an apology from the police for being stopped and searched. Your story was very high profile. Can you tell me how you've personally dealt with and reflected on that period?
My experience teaches me that we need to, as a government, as a society, we need to invest more in the mechanisms of accountability that exist to ensure that people aren't becoming attracted to alternative forms of justice or accountability, for example, violence, and that they feel confident enough to use the system as it currently stands in order to make sure that any wrongs that they have encountered can be dealt with and can be challenged in an appropriate way.
How do you evaluate the role of the intelligence services in the radicalisation, in this journey of Mohammed Amwazi?
Britain's security services, MI5 in this case, have a series of questions that need to be answered, and I think that they need to go back to the drawing board. They need to reassess the methods that they are using, because I think it can be said with some certainty that the methods and approaches that they have used, specifically in the case of Mohammed Amwazi, have played a contributing factor to him becoming Jihadi John and ISIS's chief executioner.